This program is intended for mature audiences only.
Welcome to Sex, Love, and Intimacy. I'm your host, Chip August. Today on the show, we are going to be talking about scent. We're going to be talking about our sense of smell, and we're going to be talking with Dr. Rachel Herz.
Not to denigrate the male sex, but it's really women who use their sense of smell as a key determinant for who will be the right person that they should mate with. The problem with smell and the emotional associations we make to them is once we form them, they're very indelibly imprinted. It's very hard to undo and reconnect to the same smell. So what I would actually suggest is that you tell the guy, buy a completely new cologne to wear during this phase of sort of reconnecting with your spouse, and then work on all the things about making yourself much more appealing to her. So now the new cologne smell is connected to you, so you're not working with the old smell, which has too many barriers in its way. But you pick something new, and you try to start over from there.
Dr. Herz is recognized as one of the world's leading experts on the psychology of smell. She's the author of a terrific book called The Scent of Desire, Discovering Our Enigmatic Sense of Smell. Since 2000, she's been on the faculty of Brown University. She's considered one of the foremost experts on the sense of smell, and that's led her to a bunch of radio and television interviews. She's had appearances on the Discovery Channel, ABC News, the BBC, NPR, the Learning Channel. She's had examples of her work appear in science museums around the country and is the subject of a Scientific American profile piece. She's regularly interviewed in a wide array of print media, ranging from everything from The New Yorker to The New York Times to Time Magazine. And in fact, I bumped into Dr. Herz in Psychology Today. The November-December 2007 issue had a thing on the hidden force of fragrance. So welcome, Rachel Herz.
Thank you very much, Chip.
I am really thrilled to be talking about all this, the sense of smell. I think it's sort of one of those underrated senses that people don't talk about very much. You know, we're in a visual society, sometimes a tactile society, but I notice we don't talk a lot about odor.
Well, that's completely true, and one of the reasons we don't talk a lot about odor is actually we don't have very many words to be able to describe our olfactory experiences. In fact, in any known language, there are fewer words that are exclusively related to our experiences of smell than anything else. And so we often borrow metaphors from other things to try to describe our smell experiences. But smell is also very disconnected from language at another level. It's kind of like emotion in the sense that if I were to say, tell me why you love her, it would be hard for you to articulate. And the same sort of thing is true if I say, tell me why you like that smell, or what is special about that smell experience. So it's difficult to talk about it in many ways, and people do relegate it down to the dustbin of our senses, generally speaking, because we are, as you said, so visual.
And yet, for me, it seems so related to taste, and we have all these culinary words. We have all these, you know, like taste reviews and things. We have so many words for taste, but so few for smell. Well, I wonder what that is.
Well, yes, but actually, you know, it's funny when you say taste. Taste is really only salt, sour, sweet, and bitter, and the fifth sensation, umami, which is the taste of protein. And everything else that we think we mean when we say taste is actually flavor, and it all comes from smell.
Oh.
So if you didn't have a sense of smell, your experience of food would be terrible. It would be, you know, the only thing you'd get from steak is salt. The only thing you would get from chocolate is a little bit of sweet and bitter, and, you know, depending on what kind of chocolate it was. And all of our experiences of the food world, which are so important, so hedonistically connected to us, would be completely bare.
Wow. I had no idea.
And actually, when people lose their sense of smell, they become highly depressed. And in fact, I begin the book with a little anecdote about, well, not such a little anecdote, but about Michael Hutchins from In Excess, who, as I'm sure you know, was found dead in his hotel room in Sydney, Australia, hanging from a noose that was self-made. And in terms of tracking back what led to that incident, he lost his sense of smell several years before, and it actually had an extremely devastating impact on his whole sense of being, his sense of wellness, his sense of life. And I'm not saying that was the reason why he killed himself, but the depression that became so devastating to him was partly, at least, to do with losing his sense of smell, and that happens to other people as well.
Wow. Wow. So this is really, our sense of smell is one of the keys to a sense of well-being, huh?
Yes, it's very deeply connected to our emotional existence.
And yet it seems, our sense of smell seems to me to be really personal. Like, you know, I like certain smells that my wife really doesn't like. She likes smells that I don't like. It seems very personal.
Well, that's actually a fantastic point that you raise, because unlike what most people sort of assume, that everybody dislikes the smell of skunk and everyone likes the smell of rose, in fact, all of our likes and dislikes when it comes to smell is learned, and it's either learned through personal experience or through cultural experience. I mean, the rose and the skunk is somewhat culturally based, but you're going to find individuals, myself being one of them, who say, I like the smell of skunk, and that has to do with the personal experience. So there are some exceptions to this rule when it comes to the burning sensation that certain odors bring with them, not being painful and not being aversive. But apart from that, a smell is liked or disliked because of your own personal past with it.
So for instance, I'm also a person who's not particularly turned off by the sense of skunk, but I've never actually been sprayed by a skunk. So I associate that smell for me with times when I've been out camping, times when I've had, you know, pleasant experiences in the woods, and particularly here in Northern California in the spring when the skunks are mating, you can sort of smell that musky smell, and it just sort of reminds me of sort of a woodland experience. Makes me laugh, you know. Is that why I don't, you know, like I don't have a negative experience, so it's a positive one?
Exactly. That's exactly why.
And so each of us finds our own way in that.
Exactly. Absolutely. We definitely do.
Okay, so I have this personal sense of smell, and I noticed that I'm with women, I'm with partners, right? And some smell really good to me and some don't smell really good. I think all of us have this experience of burying our nose in our partner's hair, for instance, and just, you know, the when that feels great, it's great. And then when it isn't, it isn't. You know?
Right, yeah.
Is there a lock and key kind of thing going on? Am I searching? Is my nose searching for the scent that's going to, you know, have me fall in love? Is that?
Well, a little bit of that is true, and actually, not to denigrate the male sex, but it's really women who use their sense of smell as a key determinant for who will be the right person that they should mate with.
Really?
And this goes back to an evolutionary sort of understanding of the war between the sexes in terms of, you know, the goals, et cetera, of reproduction and the human species. And it turns out, well, that doesn't turn out, but we all know that from a sort of cost-benefit analysis, and you have to realize that evolutionary theory basically comes from the idea that we're only basically walking vehicles for our genes. And
right.
The most important thing is that we are literally going forth and multiplying, getting as many copies of ourselves out there as possible.
Not just as many, but as many and each one, each generation healthier than the next.
Right. Well, the idea is that, you know, the offspring that you have should be able to reproduce and go forth and prosper themselves. Exactly. So, you know, if you had 20 children and 19 died, it would be the equivalent of having one that
right.
was successful. So it isn't, you know, pure numbers, but the idea being that if you, you know, can support the children that you have, then they will go forth and be healthy. But actually, you hit upon an extremely important point here, and that being health. And so men in this game, as it were, have very little cost, as it were, in the act of reproduction, and in, ostensibly also in the rearing of a child during a critical period of its health or early life. And as a function of this, you know, they can have hundreds, thousands of possible sexual partners. But the key word here is possible, because until the advent of genetic testing, you as a male would never be 100% certain that the little baby presented before you was yours. You have to rely on the honesty of the woman saying, this is your son, now help me out. And then you would be investing your time and energy and resources and so forth in it. However, women have, as you know, an enormous physical cost to reproduction in terms of the time of pregnancy. The fact also that prior to the, you know, development of milk formulas and so forth, if a woman stopped breastfeeding, if a woman became pregnant while she was breastfeeding, she would cease lactating.
Right.
And if there were no other food sources available, her infant could starve to death.
Right.
So you have not only all the energy and so forth that it takes to have a baby for a woman, but you have a time block, too. Let's say 3 years, you know, while you can't do anything else with anyone else. So however you know 100% for certain that this baby is your genetic material. So where does this come down to being important? Well, if I have all this invested in this little creature, I want to make damn sure that this little one is going to make it to survive and thrive and go out and be healthy and multiply herself.
Mm-hmm.
And the best way of being able to ensure that is mating with somebody else, having this baby with someone who not only is healthy, but also has an immune system, because that's where we get our health from, that's complementary to mine. And what I mean by that is it's not an overlap of everything, and it's not 100 miles away from me, but it's like that perfect match that the good things that I have will be expressed, and if I cover a certain set of diseases with my genes, then you'll cover another set. And so our child has the best chance of being healthy, him or herself. And it turns out that the outward manifestation of our immune system that everyone actually is unique for is represented by our body odor. So everybody on the planet, unless you have an identical twin, has a unique body odor, which is how the tracking dog finds you when you escape from the jail cell.
Mm-hmm.
And this unique body odor is literally your sort of odor print for your immune system. And as a woman, when I smell somebody and I say, he smells really good, it turns out what I'm actually experiencing at that moment of assessment of being really good is someone whose immune system works well with mine. Now, there's not like a one-to-one. There's a set of men that will be good for me and my genes, and a set that will be good for my best friend that could be totally different from me. So I like to say there's no Brad Pitt of body odor.
So there's not like one, I shouldn't strive for one particular smell ideal here.
No, but there are two little sort of problems with modern society that tend to mess this up a little bit. All of this is true and works when women are not taking birth control pills, so hormonal contraception. Women who do take birth control pills or some other form of hormonal contraception actually make big mistakes when it comes to smelling who smells the sexiest and deciding that guy is right for me. In fact, they pick men who are more similar to them genetically, and sort of it would be like sort of picking your brothers, as it were, as opposed to more not quite that close. But
right,
the idea
but not enough diversity.
Exactly. And the other thing, which is a problem in our modern society, is the use of cologne by men. And women are actually very influenced in a positive way by men's cologne. So a man who is biologically wrong for a certain woman can mask that and lure her by wearing a cologne that she really likes, and by the time she finds out what he really smells like, because she'll be in love with him at that point, it's too late, because he could smell like anything at that point. And if you're in love, like with the skunk example, if you like the experience emotionally, you like the smell.
Wow. Okay, now just hold this thought, because this is fascinating, and I got like lots of questions, but we want to take a pause for a moment. I've got sponsors that I would love to support because they support me. So we're going to be right back. We're talking with Dr. Rachel Herz. She's the author of The Scent of Desire. You're listening to Sex, Love, and Intimacy, and we'll be right back.
Listen to A Taste of Sex, Life in an Orgasm-Based Community, a weekly online audio program where orgasmic innovators share the intricacies of their practice on personallifemedia.com.
We're back. You're listening to Love and Intimacy. I'm your host, Chip August, and we are talking to Dr. Rachel Herz. Dr. Herz is the author of The Scent of Desire. We've been talking about our sense of smell. Rachel, when we took the break, you were saying something about how men's cologne can disguise the natural smell that a woman is looking to find out to see if our genetics are going to be compatible. I'm kind of curious about this whole thing, because I coach couples sometimes, because, you know, I lead workshops in love and intimacy and sexuality, and sometimes I hear this, actually pretty often I hear
the woman will say, I just don't like the way he smells anymore. You know, like I used to like to just get his t-shirt after he wore it and smell it. And now, you know, he just doesn't smell good anymore. What happens? Does our smell change? What happens?
Well, my theory on that, and I've also heard that very frequently from marital counselors, is that what could possibly be happening is, let's just say, because the pill has been such a primary mode of birth control, that the woman met her husband while she was on the pill, so she was actually attracted to someone whose smell was not necessarily biologically optimal for her, and that over the course of a relationship, the mode of birth control changed, and now she is no longer on the pill, and her smell, her ability to smell him, her perception of his smell has now altered such that he is now smelling like something that she would not have chosen from the point of view of biological mm-hmm. compatibility. Now, that's one possibility. Another possibility is that, like I said, because of the fact that emotion is so much the influence of why we like or dislike things, that when it comes to a relationship, if you're beginning to find the person that you are spending your time with really repugnant to you in various ways and really don't like being around them, then all sorts of things about them will become unpleasant and annoying. And because smell is so sort of viscerally emotional, it can really become the sort of blockade between, you know, becoming intimate with the person in physical terms and just sort of really the emblem of what you find disgusting or repulsive about this person now, because the sense of smell in that respect is also very much tied to our feelings of repulsion as well as to desire.
So, I don't think you're headed here, but thinking as a coach, so if I can help the couple really look at their resentments and what's fueling the repugnance, perhaps I can change the experience of the smell. And alternately, if I tell the guy he should use different cologne, maybe I can make it go better.
This is what I would think. The problem with smell and the emotional associations we make to them is once we form them, they're very indelibly imprinted. It's very hard to undo and reconnect to the same smell. So what I would actually suggest is that you tell the guy, buy a completely new cologne to wear during this phase of sort of reconnecting with your spouse, and then work on all the things about making yourself much more appealing to her. So now the new cologne smell is connected to you. So you're not working with the old smell, which has too many barriers in its way. But you pick something new and you try to start over from there.
And I have to say, in my world, it's not a lot of colognes, but I think I would tell people to change their soap, change their deodorant, change their, you know, it doesn't have to be so overpowering as cologne or perfume.
But whatever their sort of signature smell is, if they tend to use a certain shampoo or soap, like you said, that sort of becomes part of what they smell like, then to make a change, but make a change with something which has a sort of an obvious scent to it, so that the relearning can take place where smell is kind of there.
Is some of what smells pleasant to us and not pleasant to us cultural?
Absolutely. I mean, the best place to see this is with food. And like I said, food is so much about our experience of smell that you can look cross-culturally and see what one culture finds disgusting, another finds phenomenal. I mean, one of the great examples, I think, is cheese. You know, Westerners find cheese to be delicious and gourmet or comfort food with all positive connotations, whereas Asians find it totally disgusting. And there's nothing from an inherent protein or nutrient value content analysis that would dictate that. It all has to do with the cultural connotation.
Well, yeah, and of course, if you ask the average American to sample what the French would consider their greatest cheese, and most of us would consider it awful. So, you know, the Lindbergers and the Gorgonzolas, the really strong smells for a lot of Americans, it's just over the top.
Right. There's also a great example of the differences in a smell, which I think would be surprising to some of your listeners, and that's the smell of wintergreen mint. And the fact that Americans actually find this a very positive smell, in one study it was in fact ranked the most positive smell in a set of other smells that people were testing. And in the United Kingdom, it's actually considered a really terrible smell. And you'd think, you know, the U.S. and England, they're not that far apart.
Right.
Two countries separated by a common language type of thing. And yet it has to do with the connotation of those smells and how they have been culturally acquired. And it turns out that in the U.K., wintergreen smell, first of all, is exclusively connected with medicine and particularly analgesic rubs. And in fact, was very popular in an analgesic rub that was prevalent during World War II, a terrible time in that country's history. And so when people smell wintergreen, they think of war, medicine, you know, not good associations at all. Whereas for us, it's exclusively connected with candy and gum. So, you know, it's very interesting how our personal interactions with smells can produce such vast differences in response.
Okay, so now does aromatherapy work? I have friends who you know, they sort of try to treat their various ills by putting different smells in the house, you know, essential oils and things. Does that work?
Well, it works via the association connection. So it's not a pharmacological effect. So smelling lavender, for instance, is not giving you the same effect as giving, you know, taking Valium would. It is producing the effect, if it does produce an effect, because you have acquired the associations of relaxation to it. We know lavender in this country through bath and massage products and so forth, and so that's the way it's presented. And if we have an intentionality, like we want to feel relaxed and we know that this is a relaxing scent and it has that kind of emotional connection for us, then we will feel relaxed when we smell it. But if it's not, if we don't feel that way about it, then it's not going to work. If I, for instance, really can't stand the smell of lavender, it's certainly not going to relax me. In fact, it might agitate me. And so it's not the way, you know, aromatherapy, quote-unquote, works through the connections that we've formed with the smell and not because of some inherent magical or medicinal aspect of the smell that's intrinsic to it.
So there's no, I'm looking for the trick, and of course there isn't one, right? So there's no like, well, you know, if I always smell like cookies, then people are always going to like me. You know, there's no, right, there isn't one, is there?
No, unfortunately, and, you know, a great example with the so-called, you know, aromas that everyone seems to love is a story that a woman once told me about her experience with the smell of rose, and she really hated the smell of rose because the first time she ever smelled rose was at her mother's funeral. So here you have an example of, you know, in the opposite direction of something where, you know, culturally it's assumed it's a very pleasant smell and so forth, and yet an individual's experience is going to come up short. However, that being said, you know, you can make some good cultural guesses. So North Americans like the smell of cookies, and so if you use cookie smell, you'd probably make more friends than enemies.
That's kind of why I picked it. You know, it's like I think when you sell houses, they suggest like you bake cookies or bake bread.
Right, or apple pie and all those sort of homey associations get brought up. Absolutely.
I get it. And so really it's much about this link between memory and smell, this link between so if we have a positive association with something, then we have that positive association, and we're just going to use smell to kind of enhance that.
Exactly.
Yeah. So here's the thing. If I lost my sense of smell, I understand I might get depressed. I understand I would lose my taste. Will I stop loving? Will I feel less loving towards my partner because I can no longer smell her? Does that all get turned off also?
Well, that's also a fantastic question. And in fact, one of the reasons why I wrote the book, The Scent of Desire, is because I was an expert witness in a case where a woman had lost her sense of smell in a car accident. And she'd been someone who'd never really considered her sense of smell to be very important. And not only was she suffering from a serious depression when I met her, but all sorts of other aspects of her life had really fallen apart. And one of the aspects of her life that had fallen apart, and she was only, you know, 28 and had been married for a couple of years and everything was fine, and, you know, she had planned to have a family and so forth, but she felt that she could no longer be sexually intimate with her husband. She had literally lost that feeling for him because of her loss of smell. And she'd also decided that she couldn't be a mother because she was worried that she wouldn't be able to smell the burning cookies, for instance, or detect the sour milk. Now that's, you know, possibly someone who's having a more extreme reaction to losing their sense of smell than someone else might. But it certainly is definitely involved with our sense of the other, our attraction to the other, and also our sense of ourself. You know, who are we? It's kind of like being in a way blind to yourself when you lose your sense of smell and blind to that kind of emotional depth within yourself that has, you know, a sensual and a sexual quality to it.
This is all just, I love this. I could talk about this for hours and hours and hours, but I want to pause again and give a chance to let our sponsors support us and let us support our sponsors. You're listening to Sex, Love, and Intimacy. I'm your host, Chip August. Please come back after this break because Dr. Herz is going to give us an exercise, something that you can do at home. And we're going to talk a little bit more about scent and smell and all of what we've been talking about. So come on back after this break, please.
Listen to On the Minds of Men, Uncensored Sex Talk with Dr. Lori, a weekly audio program bringing the best in sex therapy to your life on personallifemedia.com.
We're back. You're listening to Sex, Love, and Intimacy. I'm your host, Chip August. I'm talking to Dr. Rachel Herz, the author of The Scent of Desire, Discovering Our Enigmatic Sense of Smell. Rachel, you've been a great guest. It's really been terrific talking to you. I'm wondering, how did you get interested in researching smell?
Well, the short answer is I was a biology undergraduate, and then when I began graduate school, I sort of made a few false starts in the sort of biopsychology realm of things, thinking that I was really more of a biologist than, in fact, I was from the animal perspective. And, in fact, I was taking a course and feeling fairly lost in terms of what I thought I was going to be doing for a dissertation when I came across a paper where the researchers had used smell to manipulate emotion rather than the typical cognitive techniques that were popular during that time. And they gave a little biological evolutionary explanation, which is something that I knew a lot about, and I was definitely, and I am, a devotee of evolutionary theory. And it just made this perfect sense to me, this connection between emotion and smell, and something I've always been interested in also is memory. And I think I'm also a very sensual person, and I always like to touch stuff and smell things. I would drive my mother crazy, you know, walking around the kitchen doing that when I was little. And it just sort of fell together at that point. And I asked my graduate supervisor if I could work on this as a dissertation topic. And he said, luckily, he said, sure, if you want to, but I can't help you. And, you know, that was lucky for me because most dissertation advisors say, do what I do, you know, be a little clone of me. And he just said, you know, go ahead. And I, in fact, I'm Canadian, and I was doing this at the University of Toronto, and I found the very few people who were actually working on this field that were all in the U.S., and I contacted them, and I appeared on some of their doorsteps to their shock, I think, and learned what they did and then applied it to what I was interested in, and the rest is history, I guess. I got lucky.
Well, I suspect it's more than luck. I think it's a lot of hard work. And also, I have to say, you have a really engaging way of talking about what you do that just makes it really, really accessible. And I'm really, really pleased to have had you as a guest. If people want to get your book or they want to know a little bit more about you, do you have a website or a way people can get in touch with you?
Sure. Well, I have a website, which is rachelherz.com. I also have a website that's scentofdesire.com, and you can get my book on Amazon, or it should be actually in any of your local bookstores, from the independents to the big sellers like Barnes & Noble. So it should be everywhere, as my publicist tells me. So definitely probably the easiest place to find it if you can't remember anything else is on Amazon, but Scent of Desire you can also see on my website.
Now, that's all one word, Scent of Desire, one word?
Yeah.
Okay. And listeners, just so you know, we'll also provide a link so that you can get to Rachel's book if you want to, just by going to our website, www.personallifemedia.com. Also want to remind you, if you want transcripts of this show or text and transcripts of any of our shows, just go to personallifemedia.com, and you can find text and transcripts and information about all of the Personal Life Media shows. I like to ask my guests if they have an exercise or something that people can do at home that can enhance love, intimacy, or sexuality. And most of my guests are more relationship experts. You're my first smell expert. But I understand you had an idea of an exercise that people could do at home. So could you share that with us?
Sure. Well, I thought of it after you told me to come up with something. So it's not, you know, well practiced, but you have told me that it actually is something other people use. And my idea was that you and your partner take turns blindfolding each other. So the person who's blindfolded is in a relaxed setting. And then the person who doesn't have a blindfold on gets to present to them a variety of different things to smell. So it could be articles of clothing, could be body parts, could be food. And the person with a blindfold on should just be, you know, without any of the preconceived constructs, what happen when we see things, just feeling and smelling and opening themselves up to that sensual aspect of themselves as well as sort of, you know, experiencing whatever they can in a neurotic way that this may bring up for them. And certainly food, too, which, as you know, is so much to do with smell and is, I think, also a very erotic and hedonistic stimulus. You can put things on each other's lips, a finger in the mouth, et cetera, that those sorts of things could also be built on from it. That, I think, would be quite nice to do.
That sounds like a very fun way to spend an evening. That sounds like it could definitely lead to all kinds of exploration. It definitely sounds like fun. Dr. Herz, I want to thank you for being a guest on the show. You've been very, very entertaining and informative.
Thank you very much, Chip, for having me.
And I want to thank the listeners for listening. If you have comments or would like to share some ideas for future shows, you can reach me by just sending an email to chip@personallifemedia.com. That's chip@personallifemedia.com. If you want to leave a voicemail for me, you can call 206-350-5333. Please leave your name, leave my show name, Sex, Love, and Intimacy, and your question or your comment. You need to leave a phone number or an email, and just know that when you leave a message on our voicemail system, you indicate agreement that we can use that message on air if we would like to use that message on air. I think that's pretty much, we're just pretty much out of time here. Brings us to the end of our show. So I want to thank you for listening, and join me again next time.
Find more great shows like this on personallifemedia.com.